It's good to be here this morning. I regard you as my family, and I enjoy being able to preach and share in front of my family. It's the only place I would really feel comfortable, and so thank you. We are in the book of Ruth still, and hasn't been that long, but we're moving right along, and if you would, please turn to chapter 4. And let's talk a little bit about where we've been so far so that we can put today in context. This is an account. The book of Ruth is an account in which God's providence and His sovereign plan are on full display. God is not a first-person character in this where you don't say, and God said this or God moved. But God is interwoven through the lives of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz. It's just, He is infused in their lives. He is an integral part of who they are and what they do. And His plan is woven throughout this whole book. I want to say this at the outset because I want us to keep this in focus. One of the main purposes of the Old Testament is to point us forward to the Redeemer, to the Messiah, so that everything in the Old Testament is like this big, huge sign, this big, huge arrow pointing us towards the coming Messiah. It is God's plan. It's showing us what God does and preparing us and preparing Israel for the Redeemer that is to come. And I also want to say one other thing, and I was thinking about this morning, especially for those of us that have grown up in the church, and we heard these stories as we're growing up. This isn't a story in the same vein as, Lord of the Rings. This actually happened. Naomi was a person. Ruth was a real person. Boaz was a real person. These were real people. They lived. And they died. And this is a retelling. So when I use the word story, please don't start to slide into that thing, well, this is a nice story. It's not a parable, folks. It really happened. And as we approach this, if you remember, we have two female main characters, Naomi and Ruth. Naomi was married to a man named Elimelech. And he and Naomi and their two sons moved to Moab because there was a drought in Israel. There was a famine going on. And so they moved down to Moab. Hey, good food down there. So they moved down to Moab. And they lived there for about 10 years. And the two sons married Moabite women, women from Moab. And of all things, all three of the men died one by one. So that what we have is we have Naomi as a widow, and Ruth and her sister-in-law are both widows, and they're all living in the same house. And Naomi's like, almost like the prodigal son. She came to her senses or whatever, and it's like, I'm going home. I got to go home. I got to go where my family and friends are. There's food in Israel. Everything's going better. I've got to go home. And so she starts off for home, and then she turns and tells the two gals, her two daughter-in-laws, hey, look, you need to go back to your families. And one does, but Ruth doesn't. And Ruth has what I'm calling a heart conversion. Because in our parlance, in this present day and age, that's exactly what it would be. She was converted at this point. She gave her heart not to Naomi. Yes, she committed herself to Naomi, but she gave her heart to God. Because in Ruth, the first chapter, the 16th and 17th verses, I'll just give you a little snippet. It says, your people shall be my people, and your God my God. This is not a small thing for Ruth. Moab was steeped in a very pagan religion. Their god was Chemosh or Chemosh, and it was a very vile religion. They had child sacrifices. And before you cluck your tongues and think that, oh man, that's just terrible, we have a whole sect of our society today that worships at the altar of abortion for privilege, for convenience. We're no better as a society than they were. And so for Ruth to turn her back on all that and turn her back on her family and set her sights on God and give her heart to God, this was no small matter. This was a total, total commitment, a total conversion. No more Chemosh, no more Moab. From here on out, her heart is God's. And they get back to Israel, and they're destitute. These are two women that are destitute. And the town, you know, they welcome them back. The ladies of the town welcome them back, and I'm sure they want to know what's been going on. They don't have any way to eat. They don't have any way to live. And so Ruth goes out in the fields and begins gleaning. So the harvesters go out, and they're whacking down the barley and whatever else they're doing. But they don't get it all. I remember when I used to berry pick, you know. I used to go, some of you guys don't even know about this because you're too young. But they used to let us go out and pick berries. And my mom ran the crews, and she would always come up my row, and she'd always come with a bucket of strawberries that I had missed. She was gleaning what I had missed. She said I didn't do a good enough job. Ruth, these guys, they're moving too fast. They're moving too hard. They can't get it all. And Ruth is allowed to go in and pick up what's left over. And that's what she's using. That's what they're subsisting on. And she ends up in the field of Boaz. Boaz is an older man, apparently unmarried, but fairly well-to-do, fairly wealthy. And he has a fairly large piece of property, and she's gleaning, and Boaz recognizes her. And it's interesting because Boaz is the only man in the book of Ruth that's identified as understanding and knowing what Naomi and Ruth are going through. It doesn't say anything about any of the other men knowing what's going on. The town women knew, the women from the town knew, but the men didn't know. But Boaz knows. Boaz listens. Boaz's an observant individual. And he says, this is a woman of character. I've heard what she's done for Naomi. I heard her commitment to Naomi and to God. This is a woman of great character. And then he begins to become her protector and her provider. He finds out she's a really hard worker. And he tells his workers, look, let her glean. As a matter of fact, leave a little extra for her. And he goes to Ruth and he tells her, just glean in my fields. We'll take care of you. Well, Boaz wins Naomi's heart, and he doesn't even know it. Ruth's heart, and doesn't even know it. And Naomi instructs Ruth to act purposefully. Okay? Now, we're gonna have two separate incidents. I'll talk about this one. We'll talk about the one that from our scripture today. I want you to understand something. When Naomi tells Ruth what to do, she's not saying, okay, so this is what we're going to do, and if he does this, then we're going to do this. And she's not trying to manipulate Ruth. She's simply putting Ruth in the position to be able to tell Boaz her heart. She's simply telling Ruth, be prepared. She's preparing Ruth so that when that opportunity comes, and it will come, that she can tell Boaz her heart. So Boaz will know. And it happens. It was a great sermon last week. It was a wonderful passage. And Boaz returns the feelings. He tells her, yes, I basically feel the same way. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of blown away that you think I'm all it. You know? But the interesting thing is they're alone. It's at night. It's dark. It's quiet. And Boaz, being the man of character that he is, puts Ruth's well-being and reputation above any other desire for her. And his character is on full display again. And he says, I want to make sure that your reputation is not sullied beyond to any degree at all. And he's very, very careful about how she acts and so that she can get out before there's any kind of whispering of what might have happened, even though it didn't. And so he's very, very careful to be protective of her again. And before she leaves, he says something else that just fleshes out his character even more. He says, you're all it, and I just would, yes, I have a desire for you as well, but you know what? I don't have a right. There's somebody else that has first rights to this, and I need to deal with that person first. And his character is shown again because he's saying, you know what? I'm doing what's right. I'm doing what's godly first. And he kind of ends with this I'm paraphrasing. He kind of ends with, he looks at Ruth and goes, I'll handle this. And he sends Ruth home. And that brings us to where we are today. So we're in the fourth chapter. We're going to read the first 12 verses. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend. Sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he, Boaz, took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he, the kinsman, said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." And the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." There's a lot in here, and some of it's not as clear as could be. And so we're going to get into this, and I actually have about 6 points. Don't suck your breath in too hard, because they're not all that long. So we're going to start with Boaz at the gate. And then we're going to talk about the nearer kinsman and the lucrative offer. We'll move on to the clause in the contract, was Ruth. Boaz the Redeemer, the blessing, and then the last point, which I'm calling Moabites Anonymous. So let's start with Boaz at the gate, because verse 1 says that Boaz went to the city gate. The city gate was essentially where the town council met. That's the meeting place. That's the business place. Everybody went to the city gate. It was the place where everybody gathered to do business and to take care of anything official. And it was a place where the men went. Boaz is purposeful. He's not waiting for chance meetings here. He's purposeful. He knows the kinsman redeemer because they're related. Okay, they may be somewhat removed as cousins, but they're related. They all live in Bethlehem. Folks, Bethlehem is not Portland, Oregon. Okay? Bethlehem isn't even Gladstone. Bethlehem's smaller than that. Okay? It's a small town, and everybody kind of knows everybody, right? He knows this kinsman redeemer, and it's interesting because this kinsman's redeemer isn't named. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it would be very easy to attribute Boaz's actions as being manipulative, but they are far from that. He's doing everything purposefully in public view with witnesses because he is making sure that the rights of everyone concerned are taken care of. I'm looking at it this way. This is interesting. When you look at how we look at this story and how we look at this account, think of it this way. I was thinking of it this way. Maybe this is just a little too secular, but I was thinking of it this way. It's as though Boaz is sitting down at a poker table, and everybody else has their cards up like this, and they're holding them close, and they can see their cards. And Boaz's cards are all on the table. There are no secrets here. He's laid them all out. Everybody can see what he has. There's no secrets. He's saying, "Here it is." was reading Matthew Henry's commentary on this, and he says that Boaz might have been a town elder himself because he was older, and he was a man of wealth and property. And so he may very well have been an elder himself. He was certainly someone prominent in the town. And he basically calls a special meeting of the town council. Hey, we're going into special session here today, folks. And he calls together 10 town elders, and he sits them down. So obviously wasn't regularly scheduled. And this nearer kinsman, this supposed redeemer, comes by. The nearer kinsman, basically what that means is this is the guy who's more closely related to Naomi than he is. Think of it as first cousins, second cousins, you know, third cousins twice removed, that sort of thing. Okay, so he's more like a first or second cousin. It seems evident that although entitled to redemption of the property that Naomi has, this kinsman he doesn't have any awareness of what's going on with Naomi and Ruth. It doesn't appear that this guy even knows that Naomi and Ruth are in town, and if he does, he doesn't know that they're destitute. You look at his response, you listen, you read what he says, and he doesn't know what's going on. And I would tell you that with privilege and rights come responsibility. And he had responsibilities. This was his family member. And she was destitute and he didn't even know it because he wasn't paying attention. Boaz informs the kinsman of this opportunity and this right to redeem the state of Elimelech. Now let me stop right here because now I'm going into these terms like redeeming and that sort of thing. And I want to make sure that we all understand what it is. Write down to our younger people. So, I remember I did a sermon a while back where I talked about redemption and redeeming, and there are several different types of meanings to the word redeeming. And so, I used the expression that redeeming was like having a coupon or a promissory note, and you already had it in your possession, and you would go redeem it, meaning you would exchange it for what it was worth, right? In this case, what redemption is it's purchasing the right to use property. So Naomi has what we would call, she was land rich and possession poor, money poor. Okay, so she had property, but she couldn't work it herself, and she had no money, and therefore she needed to sell the rights to use that property to somebody else. That was called redemption. It's a purchasing or a saving of this property. And remember I said that the Old Testament points us to Christ. The Old Testament points us to the Messiah. You can write this down. 1 Corinthians 6:20. Apparently this was important enough that Paul said it twice in the same letter because he said it in chapter 7, verse 23 as well. We are bought with a price. This property will be bought with a price. It will be redeemed for a price. Boaz informs the kinsman, this cousin, that if he wants to redeem the estate, if he wants to purchase his property, he can. But if not, Boaz will redeem it himself. Remember I told you, Boaz's cards are all on the table. He's telling the guy exactly his intentions. He is telling him, your rights come first and I honor that. And if you want to buy it, then good on you, brother. Buy it, it's your right. But if you don't buy it, it's my intention to. What's the kinsman say? Well, let me give you a little color. The kinsman goes, yeah, I want it. That's great. That's a good piece of property. I'm figuring they were that tract of land, remember Ruth and Naomi were in, Ruth, Elimelech took his family to Moab. It was about 10 years before they decided to come back. Ruth and Naomi came back. This piece of property probably was sitting there for 10 years without anything much going on because it wasn't theirs to work. This guy probably saw this property the whole time. And he knew it was Elimelech's. They were cousins. Luke 14:28 says, "For which of you desiring to build a tower does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it?" That's what this guy's doing. He's sitting down and he's got dollar signs just going ching, ching, ching in his head because he's looking at this piece of property going, yes, I can pick this up. This will go great and we're doing good right now. Remember, the harvest was bountiful. And this is good times to get property. I think it can also be inferred that he assumed that since Naomi's husband and sons both died, there wouldn't be anyone to share any future profits with. Because there is one little catch to this whole idea of redemption. If there are heirs, they share in the profit. And at the year of Jubilee, that property comes back to the original owner. And so he would have the property and it would be in his family, but he would have to share the profit with whoever her offspring was. He's looking at that, Naomi's husband's dead, her boys are dead. Hey, no way, this woman's older, she's not having any more kids. I got this. And after Naomi dies, guess what? I don't have to give the property back because there isn't anybody to give it to. He would be buying the right to use the land. But the problem is that he's looking at this thinking, Boaz introduces this clause in the contract, Ruth. He's saying, oh, by the way, if you buy the land, you also get to marry Ruth. And I can see the kinsman going, huh? What are you talking about, Ruth? I don't know no Ruth. He says, yeah, Ruth. She's the daughter-in-law of Naomi. And Ruth is, and it's possible, even Matthew Henry said this, I've read a couple different commentators that said, it's possible that Naomi said this was part of the deal. If Ruth didn't have to come with the land. But apparently, this was part of the deal, that if you buy the land, if you redeem the land, you have to marry Ruth. Because what would happen is that Ruth and whoever bought the property would produce offspring, and those offspring would be part of the estate of Elimelech and Mahlon. Okay? So, set that aside for just a second, and I want to remind you, one of the reasons we think maybe Naomi insisted on this is if you go back to what Ruth said in the first chapter, she said, where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. She's essentially saying, I want to be your daughter. And Naomi accepts her as her daughter. She's now part of the family. It's certainly, this could be a testament of the fact that Naomi considered Ruth her daughter. Boaz informs his kinsman that marrying Ruth is part of the redemption so that her dead husband, Mahlon, the son of Elimelech, would be able to produce offspring to be heirs with Elimelech. It's an interesting way of looking at things. We don't have anything to really base that on in our culture here. But essentially what happens is he marries Ruth and their offspring are part his and part Elimelech's and Mahlon's so that they have rights to that property. They can sit at the gate as property owners because they're part of that estate. They have standing in the community. The family of Elimelech continues on. Now, let me give you a hypothetical situation because this is the only way I can say this so that I can say it clearly. Let's assume for the moment that this nearer kinsman had three sons. And he's looking at this before he heard about Ruth. He's looking at this as, now I got a bigger estate. So when I pass this on to my sons, each of my sons is going to get one-third of the estate. This will be great. They're going to be well taken care of. Ruth comes along. He marries Ruth. Let's say they have two sons. Ruth and the kinsmen have two sons. Now there are five sons in the estate. So instead of his sons getting one-third, his previous three sons are going to get one-fifth. So it goes smaller, and he's diluting the inheritance that he's leaving. That's the way he's looking at it. He's not looking at Ruth. He's looking at his family. So that when he says, this is going to harm my inheritance, he's not thinking of these other sons that would be, he's not even thinking of them as his own. He's thinking of them as Mahlon's sons, not his, even though he fathered them. See, the kinsman's only desire and motivation was property. Ruth was of no interest to him. I would tell you that the essence of greed is to desire temporary things over eternal things. That's the very essence of what greed is. That becomes more important to you than anything else. And in this case, it was more important than that which was eternal, a person made in the image of God, Ruth. He was so short-sighted. And yet, he fits so perfectly into the plan of God. The sovereign plan of God, and you're going to see it as we get further along. Redemption that's based on selfish or self-centered priorities is no real redemption at all. It's redemption that's based on works. It's based on what can I get out of this? What can I do to get ahead? And that's what this kinsman's redemption was all based on. It was based on greed. So he said, no. And he was pretty quick. He didn't say, let me sleep on this, I'll come back tomorrow and think about it. It was pretty quick. I mean, it was like, no. Up steps Boaz, now the Redeemer. Boaz has already said, if you don't do it, I'm going to do it, right? He's already said, if you won't purchase this, I will. So there's not like, no, I'm not going to buy this. Whoever wants it can. He already knows who wants it. Boaz wants it. And they have this little aside in verse 7. And I'm just giving you this kind of parenthetically. And it seems that when Ruth and Boaz lived in the time of the judges, this was written probably during the time of King David. And apparently this custom didn't happen in the time of King David. Apparently this was a custom that died off. Maybe because they ran out of shoes. I don't know. But they had a custom that when they were exchanging land, when it was a contractual thing where they were exchanging land, one would take off his shoe, the other would take off his shoe, and they would exchange shoes. And it was a very public thing. And that's what's going on here. And so that when it says there was this custom during this time, it's just being explained. Guys, we don't know what this, we don't know nothing about this thing because we don't do this anymore. But this is what they did then. Think of it this way, adults, it's kind of like signing a contract in front of a notary public, right? It's being sealed. Or let's go with something even more public. Swearing in at a courtroom or swearing in to take office where you stand up in front of everybody. The most common contract that I can think of would be the marriage contract, where you stand up in front of family and friends and promise between them and God that you will honor and love each other. That's what this is similar to. It's a non-breakable, binding contract. And this was important that it would happen so that there would be no future charges of unfair dealings since everybody witnessed this. Boaz says, not only do I intend to redeem the property, but I have every intention of marrying Ruth. Oh yeah. And verse 8, I'm going to paraphrase verse 8 because the kinsman basically says, hey, she's all yours. And he backs off and we don't hear about him anymore. He's unnamed because he's it's not necessary. He's unimportant. He's a person who doesn't understand the eternal value that's right in front of him. Boaz does something that, to me, says as much about him and his character as anything else that he did. Because he's got a good portion of the town leaders there. Because it's not just the 10 elders. When you read that, you find out that there's a lot of townspeople there too. Apparently, because this was a special session, you know, it doesn't normally happen, and everybody sees 10 elders sitting down, everybody crowds around. They want to see what's going on. So we've got quite a crowd here. And Boaz stands up and he makes a public proclamation. I intend to redeem this property. And oh, by the way, I am definitely marrying Ruth. But he doesn't stop there. He says, I intend to continue the lineage of Elimelech and of Mahlon. I intend to make sure that the dead are represented in my family. He has no problem with this. He understands exactly what he's getting, and he wants it. And it is purposeful. He's telling everyone that Ruth is the most important part of this transaction. The property has little meaning to him. Remember, he's a wealthy guy, but he didn't get wealthy by, you know, throwing away valuable things. But to him, the property is not the important thing. Ruth is the important thing. And he is giving the property to their descendants in the name of Elimelech and Mahlon, and also his name. But he's making sure that that name, that family name, continues on. Very, very important in that culture. Further evidence of his character is he's stating emphatically that the real redemption here is in sacrificially giving of himself. Because he's giving away some of his own rights when he marries Ruth. He's sacrificing some of himself when he marries Ruth. And isn't that a shadow of the Messiah to come? Because his redemption of us was total sacrifice, wasn't it? Wasn't it total self-sacrifice that Jesus laid down his life for us? There wasn't a selfish iota in anything that Jesus did when he laid down his life for us. The culture there is, I like what happens because they're all right there going on. I mean, we're all so spread apart. I was thinking of it, you know, the Minners live over in Tigard, and we live out, you know, towards Estacada, and the Newmans live out in Redland, and you guys, some of you live, you know, over here in this area. We're all spread out. But over there in Bethlehem, they're all in a fairly tight community, and when something's going on, hey, you got to come down to the gate. You got to hear what's going on. And they all show up. And then when they see what's going on, in order to basically say that they agree, and not only do they agree, but they agree to the place of giving a blessing for what has happened, the people begin to bless Boaz and Ruth and their marriage. What they don't realize, they only realize half of this. They don't realize that Boaz was very careful to keep private the things that needed to be private, what had happened the night before. What had happened at the threshing floor, he was very careful to keep that private. But when it came time for something to be made public, he made sure everybody heard. He made sure everybody knew. I told you, his cards are out on the table. He's telling everyone what's going on. There is no misunderstanding. He's not ashamed. I was reminded of Matthew 10:32, where Jesus says, "Everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven." That's spiritual character. Boaz is modeling that kind of character in his love for Ruth and his commitment to Ruth. So then the townspeople get together and they start giving this great blessing, and they talk about what an honest transaction this was, how wonderful this was, and how he should be blessed, and their marriage should be blessed. And then they say this about Ruth: "May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." Isn't it interesting? The patriarch of Israel is Abraham, right? They didn't mention Sarah. They didn't mention Rebecca. They mentioned Rachel and Leah. Why do you think that is? There are 12 tribes in Israel. How many sons did Rachel and Leah have together? They produced the 12 patriarchs, patriarchal heads of each of the tribes of Israel. What they are saying is, may you have lots of sons. May your family prosper. That's what they're saying. This is a wonderful blessing. They're celebrating what's happening. They're celebrating this union that's about to happen. They're giving their blessing, and they're blessing God because of it. The town is confirming that Boaz is built fairly. They recognize that Boaz cares for Ruth, and he's not interested in adding the property to his personal assets. The character of Ruth and Boaz are recognized and lifted up as a public example. And because of that, let me step aside over here for just a second and say, now that we've seen the character of Ruth and Boaz both on public display, let me give you guys that are not married yet a charge, a challenge. Because our culture would tell you that when you're looking for a mate, that you want the latest and the greatest. The one that can, you know, be on the billboards and be in the magazines and be in the movies. You know, that beautiful, perfect woman, right? Doesn't exist. And even if it did, that's not what Boaz would tell you. Boaz would tell you, look at the woman's heart. Look at the woman's character, because that is what's eternal. That is what lasts. That is who she is. Beauty fades over the years. The character shouldn't. Character should just grow. And Boaz is saying, go for that which is eternal. The very heart of the woman. Because that's who she really is. Women, I think Ruth would tell you, be a woman of character. It doesn't matter whether or not the guy can hit a jump shot. It doesn't matter whether or not he's got a great car or a great job. I mean, it matters if he can provide for you, yes. But you're not looking for, you know, Mr. Wall Street. You're looking for a man of character. You're looking for a man who will stand by you, who will do the right things even when no one else is looking. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for a man. Anything else is just a boy. Value integrity. Value family. I shouldn't have to say that in this congregation. But value family above and integrity. That's what you're looking for. You want a mate. That's what you should be looking for. Look at each other's hearts. Above all, honor and embrace that which is godly. I think if Boaz was standing up here today, that's exactly what he would say. So as I was trying to decide how I could come up, how do we apply this? Because this happened a long time ago. We don't have a lot of people running around with just one shoe on. And so I came up with the idea of Moabites Anonymous. In order to understand what I'm about to say, we need to take a side trip to Moab. Moab is contained in what is now present-day Jordan. Okay? So you've all seen the map. I didn't get it this time, so I forgot I didn't get it up there. But it's around the Dead Sea and down south. So it's south and east. And so they're kind of a neighbor once removed. So there's a country between them and Israel. And you need to understand what Moab was in order to understand the entire depth of what Boaz did when he said he was redeeming and marrying a Moabite woman. Because Moab was a country that at its very conception was cursed. And I use that word properly, conception, because Moab was actually conceived in incest with Lot and his oldest daughter. And Moab was cursed from day one. And the entire nation lived under a curse. Numbers, if you was reading John MacArthur, and he was talking about Numbers 23-25, and it tells of opposition that Moab had towards Israel. They had a history of opposing Israel. They had a history of oppressing Israel. They had a king that hated Israel so much, he went out and found a prophet for hire. Okay, think about this. You know, like a hired gun prophet? His name was Balaam. You guys all remember the story of Balaam, right? Balaam was the prophet that was riding the donkey and headed, you know, and the donkey came to a complete stop. Read the story. It's in, the account is in Numbers 23-25. But essentially, the word of the Lord came through the donkey since Balaam wasn't listening. Okay? And just as a side personal note, that's what I remind myself every time I preach. That God doesn't need me. He used a donkey once. He just needs me to be available and willing. It's His word that's important. Moab worshipped Chemosh. I told you about that. I know I told you they were known for child sacrifices. It seemed like every kingdom around Israel, when you read about it, every kingdom around Israel, they were into child sacrifices. I don't know how those kingdoms ever grew. They must have had lots of kids. Ruth's conversion was no small matter. I told you that before. It was total commitment. Because she came out of that culture. Judges 3 tells us that Moab oppressed Israel for a number of years, maybe as many as 18 years. They weren't good neighbors. And out of all of this comes Ruth. Ruth comes out of Moab. Ruth's a Moabite. I was trying to think if I could... I don't even know if it would be the same thing today if I said, well, they came from North Korea. Or they came from Iran. Or they came from Syria. Some place where you would go, well, okay, we'll talk, but you stay over there. Some place where you didn't trust them. Some place where there was history. Okay? And it wasn't good history. All right? That's where Ruth comes out of. She comes out of all that. These people know that. They know she's a Moabite woman. Remember, they're Jews. They live in Israel. She's Moabite. She lives in Moab. That's down over there. She's going to look different. She doesn't look like a Jew. They know she's a Moabite woman. They know she came with Naomi. And Boaz redeems her. He redeems the outcast enemy of Israel. Boaz declares in verse 10 that Ruth is now redeemed and she will now be the bride of Boaz. That's how serious this was. This wasn't just like, oh yeah, she's cute. I like her. Let's get married. This was deadly serious. Moab and Israel were not friends. They had a very, very contentious relationship. So as I looked at that and I said, well, if I can get just a little bit of a handle on that, I feel almost like I'm at one of those 12-step meetings. Hi, I'm Steve. I was a Moabite. Weren't you? Because I was born in sin. Weren't you? I lived a life of sin. I worshiped the God of this world before I came to know the Lord. I was a Moabite. I was unworthy. And by all standards, I was unredeemable. Fortunately, the only standard that really matters is God's. And yet, at the same time, I couldn't even begin to start to be redeemable. I was lost. I needed a redeemer. You needed a redeemer. Because I got news for you. You were a Moabite. It doesn't matter. We all were born in sin. God provided that redeemer. He made a way that I, his enemy, could be redeemed. That's what this story points to. That's what this account shows us, is the foreshadowing of what's going to happen. Paul, in Galatians 3:13, he says that Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law. He purchased us. You ever heard the phrase, purchased by the blood? That was the cost. His life, his spilt blood. I've said before, it's a oxymoron that blood can clean anything. Blood is like, trust me, I deal in this. Blood is like the worst thing possible. And yet blood washes away every sin, doesn't it? That's what Christ, that was the currency. That's what Christ used to redeem us, was his own blood. In Galatians 4:4-5, he says, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. I was just sitting there marveling at the open mic this morning. Adoption as sons. Titus 2:14. Paul says it over and over again in his letters. Jesus gave himself for us to redeem us. After Boaz identifies Ruth as a Moabite in verse 4:10, guess what? She is never referred to as a Moabite anymore. That's the last time. She has been redeemed, folks. She's no longer a Moabite. When you're redeemed, you're no longer of this world. You are now part of God's family. You're now part of our forever family. You've been redeemed. God no longer sees me as a Moabite or a sinner, but as His child. I get to sing the song that the songwriter wrote, "Since I have been redeemed." It's not a trite old hymn. It means something. As I start to wrap this up, I want to remind you that God's providence and sovereign plan are on full display here. You don't hear the voice of God. You see God working through the people. You see their character being used by God so that the right people end up in the right places. God has laid out a plan. I can tell you right now that this plan of Boaz marrying Ruth was laid out before the foundation of the world. How do I know that? Because God said that our salvation was planned far before the foundation of the world. Everything that's happened has already been taken care of, already been planned by God. It's His plan on display here. It's His plan to show us, to model for us, redemption. And redemption most pure. The kinsman redeemer is like salvation by works, isn't he? This kinsman redeemer, it's temporal. It's built on that which perishes. He only cared about that which perishes. His heart, his motivation were on full display. He apparently didn't take notice of what the entire town knows of Naomi and Ruth's plight, right? He didn't know. He's consumed by his own affairs. Boaz is the redeemer whose salvation, and I use that word correctly, his salvation is by grace. He saved her from destitution. He saved her from starvation and death. He redeemed her. And it was based on love and not on earthly things. His heart, his motivation were on full display. He values that which is greater. He puts Ruth's well-being above his own. We call that sacrificial love. Jesus gave up his life for our redemption, our salvation. We call that sacrificial love. Jesus said, "Greater love has no man than what? He laid down his life for his friends." Isn't that the ultimate sacrifice? And he gave the ultimate sacrifice for us. Boaz is an imperfect example because he's a human. He's an imperfect example, but he is a foreshadowing of the love and sacrifice of the coming Messiah. He is this imperfect example of what's coming. It's like, hey folks, guess what? You've seen this? What's coming is even better. What's coming is even more. What's coming is more perfect. The blessing of the townspeople of Bethlehem is an affirmation of the redemption. The witness of the Holy Spirit in our hearts is an affirmation of our redemption. The purposeful lives we lead are witnessed and testified to by our brothers and sisters in the Lord. This is also an affirmation. This is a public affirmation. The fruit of your life is a public affirmation that you've been redeemed. We're all from Moab. We're all born in sin, and there is only one redemption, only one salvation, and that's through Jesus Christ and through His mercy and grace alone. Paul says in Ephesians 2:8-9, "For by grace you've been saved by faith, and this is not of your own doing. It's the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast." This is why we're so adamant here from this pulpit, and we're unbending that it's the gospel of grace alone, sola gratia, by grace alone. Not by anything that we could do. Ruth couldn't redeem herself. We can't redeem ourselves. It's only through Jesus Christ, only through His sacrifice, only through His blood. I think this passage today basically says redemption through grace alone. Because that's what Boaz extended to Ruth, was mercy and grace. So what about you? Have you been redeemed? Are you still hanging on to your Moab heritage? If you've been redeemed, then do you need a fresh reminder that it's through grace alone that you've been bought? That working to try to be good enough will never be acceptable to God. We all need to work and act on the grace we've been given, but our reliance must never be on our performance, but rather on the saving grace of our Redeemer. Jesus was, is, and always will be the perfect Redeemer. As we move to communion, I'm reminded of the words that he spoke. This is my body broken. This is my blood poured out. It's the purposeful, unselfish, sacrificial love act of a true Redeemer. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for just the vitality of your word, Lord, how it's alive, how this story, even though thousands of years old, Lord, still tells us of redemption, Lord. It still points us to the cross. It still points us to you. We thank you for that. We thank you for the fidelity of your word, Lord. In a day and an age when people are trying to discount it and disprove it, Lord, it just shines through more and more that your word is your word. And it's perfect. And we thank you for that. We praise you. We bless your name, and we humbly come to you this morning in communion in your name.